This is Radio 314 on the Red Ice Radio Network.
Good day to you. This is Lana. At the time of this recording, it's Friday, or Fredag in Swedish, which is Freya's day. Freya is a beautiful goddess in Norse mythology. Being a cat person myself, I especially love how she rides a chariot pulled by two cats. It's funny because most of my friends are cat people too. We're going to jump right into the interview with William Flowers, who's the vice chairman of the Georgia League of the South. You might have heard about the League of the South recently from the lamestream news, or perhaps the SPLC or ADL. You know, the usual rhetoric used against white people who won't allow themselves to be bullied. Neo-Nazi, racist, bigot, homophobe, etc., etc. Does this even work on people anymore? It's like hearing a fanatical religious zealot speaking. There's no reasoning with these people. It's time for a divorce. It's not working. It's you, not me. You can hear some of William's speeches on YouTube, such as the one on the steps of the Alabama State Capitol, where he addressed over 1,000 supporters. We'll discuss why the establishment seeks cultural genocide of the Southern people. William also shares how the South is undergoing another Reconstruction era. He'll articulate the message of Southern nationalism and how peaceful secession can be achieved. William Flowers, coming up. Welcome, William. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you, Lana, for having me. It's a pleasure to be on the show, and I appreciate the invite.
Well, I'm happy to have you here. I was really moved by your speech at the League of the South conference, and I admire your courage to literally shout out from the streets in defense of Southern people. So, well done.
Well, thank you very much. They certainly need that voice right now, and it's really not out there the way that I would like to see it. So I decided to go ahead and step up and try to be that voice for my people.
Well, for people who don't know you, let's begin with an introduction to you and also the League of the South.
Okay, well, my name's William Flowers, and I'm the recently appointed chairman of the Georgia League of the South, formerly vice chairman. I received the appointment to the chairmanship on August the 1st, which was the same day that I delivered a speech in Stone Mountain, Georgia. I was born and raised in Southeast Missouri. I was born in 1981. I'm 33 years old. And in Southeast Missouri, the culture and the people are very Southern. I know there's a lot of people that hear Missouri and they say, oh, well, that's the Midwest. Well, in the part that I grew up in, it was very Southern, very close to Western Kentucky, Western Tennessee, and Northeast Arkansas.
Well, tell us about the League of the South and what's their mission?
Well, the League of the South is a modern-day Southern nationalist movement, and our goals are to fight for the survival, well-being, and independence of the Southern people by all honorable means. And this is a political struggle that we're engaged in. And we are secessionists. We are the real secessionists of the modern era. We promote the secession of the South to once again form a nation state or collective of Southern nation states that are politically autonomous and sovereign and can determine the destiny of their own peoples.
Yeah, we'll definitely get into some of these concepts a little later. But I wanted to know, you've grown up in the Southern area. So tell us how you've seen it change since you were a child.
Well, the South has changed quite a bit since my childhood, not just demographically speaking, but also culture competitions between various groups that have either been imported into the South or have arrived here on their own volition. Where I grew up at, it was very rural, very agrarian. My father was a farmer. My mother was a seamstress. Very simple people. I come from very humble origins and a humble background. But the South, I've been in Georgia since 2000, and the South has certainly been changing constantly since I've been here. And a large part of that is the demographic shift. And it's very noticeable. From the time when I was a child, you know, there was no question about which culture was dominant. And there was no question about what people were the majority and made up the majority of the people. It was very clear and very well understood by everyone that, you know, European culture, Southern European culture, or the Southern folk, as we call them, were certainly the dominant sections of society, and that is slowly changing. The importation of illegal immigrants, third world immigrants from all corners of the globe, are slowly but surely changing the culture of the Southern people. And there are a lot of ethnic and cultural issues that are springing up from this, and a lot of cultural competition. You don't see assimilation from these different peoples who are coming here. What you see is enclaving. And this creates a competition and, to some degrees, an animosity. And it's very prevalent today.
I've also noticed it seems Almost like the South is going through another Reconstruction era, but a Marxist one, because there's a lot of Northerners that are living in places like Charleston. You go there, you don't hear many Southerners anymore. It's all these Northern people, and a lot of them are very left. Have you noticed that?
Absolutely. Well, you know, and a lot of this are transplants. You know, these people are transplants from the North, from Yankeedom, as we call it. Most of them are white liberals, and most of them are anti-white in their worldview and their philosophy. They live in a perpetual state of shame based on European culture and colonialism and all of these other things that are drummed into them at institutions of higher learning, many of them in New England and many of them in the North that really promote these ideas. But now a lot of Southern universities and a lot of the professors on the staffs there are Marxists and even communists, open socialists in their leanings. And so they help to perpetuate this, and they help to change the way the people view themselves. And you see a lot more self-flagellation than you did in the past. Being a white Christian Southerner is no longer a positive thing in the eyes of many of the people.
That's right. Yeah, I've also noticed it seems like, well, it is true. All the papers in the South are also owned by Northern leftists, and now they're programming Southern people into their ideology.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, if you look at Southern newspapers on any given day, especially in the major cities in the South, you'll definitely see this streak of vehemently anti-Southern opposition, which is striking when you consider the geographic location of these places, but not so striking when you really understand who these people are and what they're doing and their worldview and their philosophy. They want to see the Southern people held in a constant state of denigration. They feel that we should live in a perpetual shame for our ancestors and for their actions. And the Southern people, by and large, do not feel this way. We're very proud of our people. We're very proud of our heritage. We love our ancestors and we love our own folk. But still, there is the social stigma that's attached to a lot of this propaganda that's being, you know, disseminated to the masses. And it does have an effect over time because there's such a large volume of it. And the outlets that are disseminating it are so influential. So you do see this change in personality. You see this change in the way people view themselves and the way they view their own organic communities.
I mean, really, put on any Will Ferrell movie or any comedy and they're just slamming the South all the time. They're just stupid, racist, everything else. Have you noticed that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, that's racist is probably the most common slur that's used against Southern people. Or Southern people are represented in Hollywood productions to be a bunch of dumb, redneck, inbred hillbillies that are not very intelligent and are very simple. And although I think it's true to say that the Southern people, in a way, are very simple and have a certain degree of innocence in the way that they view the world, they're anything but simplistic. The most intelligent minds that I've ever encountered and some of the sharpest people that I've ever met have been Southerners. And a lot of these people were not educated in Ivy League institutions. You know, they came from Southern universities, and some have not even been through the university system at all. But they have a very fundamental and practical knowledge of life, a very simplistic understanding of concepts and how to apply those concepts to certain areas. So this myth that the Southern people are in some way inferior in their intelligence, or that they're a bunch of redneck inbred hillbillies who are incapable of cognitive function is simply it's a misnomer.
And the South was the richest part of America for a time. That's when the North was trying to rob them to pay all their tax money, you know?
Absolutely. Well, you know, Abraham Lincoln, he even mentioned that when he was asked by someone, why won't you let the South go? And he responded with, I can't let the South go. Who would pay for the government?
That's right. Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah, there was a movie, was it Dukes of Hazzard, the new one that came out? Absolutely horrible. And it was this Jewish man that was the screenwriter. And he said he had never been to the South, but he had written just all this just malarkey into the script. I couldn't believe it. It's usual. You know, people usually haven't been down to the South. They haven't seen. They don't know what it's actually like.
Well, absolutely. And I'm not surprised that the gentleman who did that was a Jewish individual. You know, it's no secret. Anyone who reads Israeli newspapers or anyone who reads major publications within the United States, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, it's very easy to see that, you know, this media establishment is largely dominated at the editorial levels And even a lot of the reporters, if you just look at the bylines, it's dominated by a very high concentration of Jewish people.
That's right.
So it's no secret that they have a very, striking animosity towards Europeans and especially Southern Europeans on the North American continent. I think they've made that painfully obvious.
So when did you start waking up to the war on Southern people and cultural Marxism?
Well, to be quite honest, even as recently as 2005, 2006, I was what you would consider just a typical Republican conservative. That was my political viewpoint, my outlook. I always took pride in being a Southerner, and I always identified as being a Southerner. I was taught from an early age by my father and my grandfather. They would set me on their knee and tell me these stories of these heroic Southern men who fought against tyranny and who fought in rebellion against the United States government for various reasons. But it was something that was always ingrained in us from the time that we were small. We were to take pride in our heritage. We were to love our ancestors and their achievements and their accomplishments. But I really didn't begin to wake up probably until around 2008, 2009. At that point, I began to realize that there were some very serious problems. And they weren't just problems that were affecting the South per se, but they were affecting everyone on a global scale. And of course, this was the time frame when the Great Recession began to set in. And we had, dire economic problems, and life was changing very drastically for many people, especially throughout the South. So this really caught my attention, and I began to investigate further. I shifted my political leanings more from, being a standard conservative or Republican, more towards libertarianism. And then you had Ron Paul. He came along and had his campaign there, and was it 2012, I believe, and that garnered a lot of attention and drew a lot of people in because he had a lot of ideas that I thought were excellent ideas and I would like to see implemented. But then the more I analyzed what he stood for and basically what he was advocating, it seemed to me to be more about sound money for, everyone from third world invaders to legitimate citizens. And this did not, this did not strike me as being very productive for our people and our future. So this began my gravitation more towards ethno-nationalism. And I discovered the League of the South in 2013. I attended a small demonstration in Vidalia, Georgia. It was actually a joint demonstration. There was one in Uvalde, Georgia, and one in Vidalia. I attended that demonstration. I met many members of the League of the South, including our president, Dr. Michael Hill. I spent that weekend with them and talked with them about, our worldview and politics. And I knew that I had found my home at that point with Southern nationalism.
Yeah, it's interesting how a lot of libertarians, they just don't care about culture. They don't think it's important. They don't understand the need for borders. I mean, really, their culture is all about money. It's all about materialism. It's all about the market. And I'm really quite sick of it, too.
Absolutely. I call it reckless individualism.
Yeah. Now, you call yourself a nationalist, but we have to clarify, you're not an American nationalist. You're a Southern nationalist, correct?
That's exactly right. We are not civic nationalists. We are Southern nationalists. And in our view, in our world political view, a Southern nationalist is an ethno-nationalist.
Now, why do you think leftists have so much hatred for Southerners? Why are they seeking this cultural genocide? What is it about the Southerners?
Well, I think there is a prevailing view among liberals and leftists, communists, cultural Marxists alike, that the Southland of the United States and the people who inhabit that region, our people, the Southern folk, are in some way holding the rest of the nation back from this glorious liberal utopia that could be established. And I think that they see us as a stumbling block to ultimately realizing the vision that they would like for the entire nation, or for the entire country, rather. I don't view America as being a nation. I'm a folkish individual. My view of nationalism is a folkish view. And of course, if you look at the definition of a folk and what a folk is, it's the common people of a society or a region that's considered as the representatives of a traditional way of life, especially as the originators and the carriers of the customs, beliefs, arts, and things of this nature that make up a distinct culture. And the most archaic understanding of a folk is a nation or a people. And that's exactly what we say as Southern nationalists. We are a nation. We are a people. And the word nation, when you trace it back to the Latin form, which is natio, it means a people, a tribe, a kin or genus. You know, the implications are that this is ethnic or racial in its understanding. But yet today in the 21st century, this very common understanding that's been around for thousands of years has had a radical overhaul. And it's been changed to where a nation now is viewed in the eyes of the American people in a civic manner based simply on location, geography of a city or a polity or a village. No matter who lives there, no matter what their origins or their identity or their culture, they are all citizens of this nation. Well, for Southern nationalists, we're ethno-nationalists. We don't view it that way. We view that the Southern people are the Southern people of European descent. You know, we are the originators of the Southern culture.
That's right. And we have to clarify that over and over. I'm so glad you did that. A nation is the people. It has nothing to do with the government. And it has nothing to do with I'm a Nazi that wants to kill 6 million Jews either.
That's right.
Well, people listening to this show, they know that our politicians have betrayed us. They don't represent our interests. But still, some have hope in, you know, conservatives and Republicans. So how can we win these people over to our side? Do you think this is going to just happen over time as they see how bad it gets? Or what do you think?
Well, I think as things get worse and gradually worse and worse, sure, I think we will win some of them. But, you know, sadly, I think there's a large portion of them that we probably will never win. But in all honesty, I don't think that we need all of them. What we need are the people who are fighters and the people who love their people and who love their folk and who love their culture. You know, we need the people who realize this on their own. And of course, we should spend time trying to wake up those who don't. You know, I spend a considerable amount of my own time trying to do that with my public appearances and my speeches. I think there are a lot of people who see this, and I think there are a lot of people who have a very deep intrinsic understanding of what a nation really is and a people really is. But I think a lot of them are still hanging on to this illusion that this political establishment is still viable and that the next conservative or the next Republican or the next libertarian that we can vote in is going to be the savior and the end all be all. You know, I don't view the conservative establishment or the cuckservative establishment as riding in on a white horse at the 11th hour to save our people because they've already turned their backs on us. They've abandoned us. It was well understood for a very long period of time that the base of the Republican Party, especially in the South, was made up of white Southern Christian people and very conservative people. And now they seem to transform into the new left. I think it's an appropriate term for them, or cuckservative. They're no longer concerned with their own constituency and their own power base. They're now pandering to be the new party of inclusion, the new party of immigration, the new party of tolerance and acceptance. They're basically competing with the left to try to see how many votes they can garner from those who have more leftist leanings, which is a suicidal strategy. And it alienates those who truly care about their people. So that's turned me against them completely. I think all of them are backstabbers. The leftists are communists and cultural Marxists. Most of the conservatives today have become cultural Marxists. So in my view, they're all our enemies. None of them can be trusted.
I agree. Well, do you think it's important for us to have some people running in politics? I mean, how is secession going to happen? Is this going to be done legally, or how do you see this happening?
Well, it's my hope that it certainly would be done legally. Do I think that it's going to be productive at this stage to have people running in elections? I think if you had enough of them, it would be. But one of the things that I tell the people, Lana, when I go out and speak is that, you know, the politicians are not only backstabbers, but Southern nationalists don't believe that change can come through this political system or that it can be reformed. Because the people who are in control of these avenues to power, you know, they are the very cultural Marxists who want to see our annihilation and destruction. And I think they'll certainly work overtime to stifle any efforts on our behalf to try to make gains through the modern political system. But let's say, for instance, even if we were able to, let's say, field a small number, 7, 8, 9, 10 candidates in one particular state to run for the legislature. And let's say that we got these 7 or 8 good guys in there. They would be immediately outnumbered. They would be marginalized, and I don't think they would have a great effect. And this is one of the reasons why I'm in favor of first building a mass movement. And when we talk about a mass movement in the Southern nationalist sense, we're not just talking about a political movement as in potential voters. We're talking about a political ideological movement. We're talking about training the Southern people in an ideological fashion so that they understand that not only are Southern nationalists speaking the truth to them, but they understand why that truth is relevant and why it's important to their survival and future. And if you can build this mass movement of ideological supporters first, you know, let's say in Georgia, we could reach the point where there were 100,000 Southern nationalists, then yes, absolutely. At that point, it would be perfectly viable to try to make gains through proper political avenues. But you wouldn't even necessarily have to run people for office. If you could create a movement that was large enough, it could definitely exert pressure and influence on the legislators that were currently sitting in office, or any who would follow them up and take their place. And you could certainly wield a considerable amount of influence and power through that political pressure and through the influence of your numbers. You wouldn't be able to be ignored or mocked or denigrated. They would have to listen to you. And if they didn't listen to you, then through peaceful demonstrations, you could march in with 100,000 and shut down Atlanta, let's say. And then they would have to listen to you. But we need numbers, I think. I think it's very important. It's very crucial. And that's why I'm in favor of building a mass ideological movement before, you know, really aspiring to political ambitions.
You're right. It has to be the will of the person to survive and to say, I will not be genocided. So no matter what you bring at me or fling at me, I'm not going to let you take me out or my family or my people. It has to be a hardened thing within, like a spiritual conviction, right?
That's exactly right. You have to solidify yourself internally, and you can't sit on the sidelines and say, you know what, I'm going to be silent. You have to be that kid that won't be quiet and will make waves in the pool. You know, you have to make sure that they're hearing your voice. And I think that much of this can be accomplished through very peaceful means and legal means. I don't advocate violence. I don't advocate illegal activity. What I advocate is reaching out for the hearts and the minds of our people. And I believe that eventually, and it may take years, but eventually, as the situation around them deteriorates, and as we continue to push and pound our message and continue to disseminate our own propaganda, I think that it will reach the people. I think that it will. And I think that you will have many people that will see the light and say, yes, we see now that the Southern nationalists truly cared. We see now that they really cared about our interests and our people, and we see that they'll fight for our future. And I think that you will have, you know, you will have certain times where your growth will be much larger than at other times. But I think the economic situation is going to get worse. That will certainly drive more discontent, and more people will be looking for solutions and looking for, you know, a group or a movement that will be able to help to work with them and to fight to make their lives better. I mean, you look at what Golden Dawn has accomplished in Greece.
Yep.
You know, Golden Dawn has gone from being a small, marginalized, negatively viewed movement to being basically a second functioning state within a state, because they've won the people through their charity and through their help and through their very pro-Greek program. Now, a lot of people will condemn Golden Dawn for some of their other political views, but at the same time, look at what they've accomplished, and you can't ignore that, of course, they've had much worse economic situations than we've had here. But I think we have the potential to see something very similar. And Southern nationalism needs to be poised, and the League of the South needs to be poised to seize upon that when the opportunity presents itself.
I think it's important too what you're doing. I mean, showing presence, basically shouting on the streets, letting people know, hey, there's other people out there, because we need to get people feeling unified. We need them to become fiercely loyal and protective of their people, because we've been told, it's racist to want to feel this or share this bond. But it's about getting that folk consciousness switching on again, because I think that's a really powerful first step. Wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely. Absolutely. People have to view themselves as being connected to a larger organic entity. You know, because this not only gives them a sense of self-esteem and a sense of innate power, but it also gives them a connection to their larger folk. It gives them something to fight for. You know, it's the Greeks have a saying, you know, societies grow great when old men plant trees in whose shade they know they'll never sit. And we have to develop the same mentality. We have to fight for those who are going to live after us. We have to fight for what we're going to leave them. But we can't do this without an awakening of the conscience of our people. They have to be with us, and they have to understand that we're fighting for their survival, for their preservation. And it's not because we hate any other parties. You know, I have no personal animosity towards any other race or any other people or any other ethnicity. I simply love my own more than I love all of the others. And what's very what's very striking to a lot of people when they're beginning to see it, they're beginning to wake up, is that if you're approaching this from a leftist perspective, it's perfectly legitimate to organize political action and movements based on ethnic or racial lines. You know, you have the NAACP, for instance, or you have La Raza, which in Spanish literally translates as the race. And these are perfectly legitimate organizations, and they're viewed in a positive light by especially leftist media and even by many conservatives. But if a white group of Southerners decided to form an organization like the League of the South, which we have, and we approach the same, you know, political recognition, we're immediately demonized as Klansmen, as neo-Nazis, as bigots, as racist. But I think this double standard does our opposition much more harm than good as time passes, because people begin to see through it.
I think it's also so predictable, and most of us are at that point now, just laugh it off and shove it back in their face. Like, it just doesn't affect me. You could say whatever you want, and it drives them mad when you're not affected by it.
Well, absolutely. You know, our League of the South and Southern Nationalist activists, we encounter this whenever we do street demonstrations and opposition is present. You know, we have communists, we have Marxists that show up out there in the streets. And of course, they shout that we're racists and neo-Nazis and bigots. And our response to them is simply, listen, you can call us whatever name makes you feel justified in persecuting us and hating us, but we will continue to fight for our people and love our people, and we will never surrender. So call us what you will. We don't care. So what? We're here to fight for our people. We're here to stand up for our own, and we're going to continue to do that regardless of what you say or what you think. It does make their heads want to explode. You can see the frustration and the anger that swells up in them immediately.
Well, the other side thinks in terms of long-term strategy. They've been blatantly saying it's a matter of time before your lineage turns brown, and in years to come, white people won't exist, and that's a good thing. But we also should be planning our war against them in the long term. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Our enemies, they definitely have a long-term strategy. And there is, in my opinion at least, a genocide that is taking place of the Southern people and of the ethnic traditional Southern stock. There is a genocide that's taking place. The problem that you run into is that most people have been conditioned to view genocide as being an all-out war or tanks and bombs, mass murder, mass graves. They believe that this is the form that genocide must present itself in, and this is simply not the case. Now, if you read the articles of Geneva, where it's discussing genocide and the definition of the term itself, you know, systematically bringing about the conditions, and this means whether you're importing, you know, hundreds of thousands of third world immigrants into an area that at one time was ethnically, you know, monotonous and homogenous, you know, you're bringing about calculated situations in order to reduce the people that are currently there or to destroy those people. Even if it's long term, it doesn't have to be immediate death. This can be a long term process where you flood, let's say, a European country, like we're seeing all throughout Europe and even in the Southland right now, where you flood these white European peoples with third world immigrants at such an amazing level that eventually you reach a critical mass where either there's going to be a huge conflict or the indigenous people will no longer survive. The ethnic Europeans who inhabit the land will no longer survive. And this is exactly what they're pushing for. This is what they want. They can't afford to have a homogeneous European society because the people who are in control of this system, these cultural Marxists, their vision of the world, the only thing that could stop that, or that they fear could stop that, would be another Nazi Germany. You know, another European people with a racial consciousness and a racial awakening that realizes that they are extensions of each other and they must fight for their own future and their own people. They're terrified of that, and this is why they flood us with third world immigrants.
I always wonder, you know, if the anti-whites in power, if they hate the South so much, then why don't they just let them break off into their own country?
Well, I mean, I think there are different theories about that. I think a lot of it has to do with control. You know, I think they don't care too much for the Southern people, but at the same time, you know, I think they'd like to have control over the South and control over the Southern people. I think they might be frightened about who we might make allies with if they were, you know, to allow us to break away and to be free. But make no mistake, you know, I believe at least, and perhaps, you know, some people say that it's a naive belief that we could ever actually realize secession again and that we could have secession again. I think it's perfectly legitimate, and that's what I believe is going to happen in the future. I mean, I see a balkanization, if you will, of the regions of the North American continent. And
Definitely.
I think that's coming in the future. So I don't think it's a matter of will secession be practical or possible. I think it's only an issue of when this will be practical and when it will be possible. When will the opportunity present itself? Scotland had a referendum on secession here. What was it, last year? You have secessionist movements in California, even as liberal as California is in the northern part of the state. You have strong secessionist movements. You have gentlemen in the Pacific Northwest, like the Northwest Front types. They would like to see some form of secession. There's a growing movement now for people in Appalachia, which makes up, it's a portions of nine different states where the majority demographic is white and the terrain is mountainous. Even there's been talk of an Appalachian secessionist movement. So secession is coming, and it's unavoidable because time and history is cyclic. And the way that you know for sure that secession is the future is because secession was the past. And the cycle always comes back around. The United States was formed basically with a secession from Great Britain. And the South land of America, the Confederate States, they were formed with a secession from the Union. And it's only a matter of time before this cycle comes back around and it continues. And I have no doubt that it will.
Yeah, I like to say this a lot, but I still feel this. I think buying land, holding private property with like-minded people, I mean, of course you could do this covertly, otherwise you'll be labeled Nazi town, but get some friends together, buy up land, build some things, get self-sufficient together. It doesn't have to be a hippie commune. It could be anything you want it to be. It could be classy and high-end, or it could be, very basic, but creating our own little self-sufficient communities. And I think that probably would be the best thing for us, even mentally and spiritually, to get back on the land and away from the cities. What do you think about that?
Oh, absolutely. And there's been a lot of conversation and a lot of debate about that. I can tell you that for sure. I've even participated in some of it. The problem that you're going to run into, in my opinion, with that is that you're going to have generational Southerners who have lived in certain areas for a long time. In the Southland alone, I have many friends whose families have inhabited the same piece of ground for 300 years. So these people are not going to be willing to flee from this land and simply give it over to others in order to form these enclaves that we're talking about. I think that we can build a mass movement of people, and I think that these people don't necessarily have to reside in the same geographic area, but they can still help and assist each other. For some people, it's not going to be economically feasible all to move to the same area. Let's just imagine it. We will, for a moment, a little thought experiment. Let's say that there are a certain number of jobs available within this geographic area that everyone's planning on flooding to and creating this commune. Okay, how are they going to sustain themselves economically? If you have, an influx of 5 or 6,000 people into an area that only has, let's say, 700 or 800 jobs. Then of course there's not going to be work for all of them, and this is going to create issues and poverty for a large section of them. And so this is some of the problems I think you're going to see with trying to form these enclaves, these ethnic enclaves. But I don't think you have to live in close proximity in order to assist each other. And Southern nationalists, we do this all the time. We have members all throughout the South, South Carolina, Florida, Alabama, Mississippi, Tennessee, Georgia. And there's nowhere in the South that any of us, would be able to travel where we would not have someone there who could support us or could put us up for the night or could share a meal with us or we're very closely connected in the real world, although we don't necessarily live in very close proximity.
Yeah, we need to start getting more creative here. I'm thinking businesses, more, larger businesses that can employ more people. We need to get a serious work ethic and be very industrious so we could still deal with the rest of the world, but kind of be separate. The Amish do it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Oh, it can be done, Lana. I'm not a doubter that it can be done. It's only a question of how practical it
Yeah,
is.
it's difficult.
When, given the individual situation of many Southerners, how practical would that be?
Come on, cash in on your white privilege. I know you have money, shake it up.
Right. If
Get your invisible knapsack and pull out $1 billion.
only it were that simple, And this is a term too that I hope to eradicate one day from the common vernacular, this white privilege. I don't think there's ever been a greater lie that's ever been told, as far as from a social perspective anyway, about Southern Christians, white people in general, is this white privilege nonsense. I was never afforded any privilege simply because I was white. I worked very hard for everything I've ever had in my life. And those who did not work as hard did not achieve as much. Not that I've been a huge success on the levels that I hold myself to or the standards that I hold myself to, but at the same time, there were certainly no white privilege ATMs that I was able to hit up along the way and help me in my journey.
That's right. I mean, it's pretty basic. You get back what you put out. That's just always how it's been, you know. It's like a basic principle on this planet, you know. If you don't go out and catch your food, you will starve.
Well, we live in an entitlement society now, Lana, especially here in, you know, on the North American continent, where everyone's looking for a handout. Everyone's, what can you give me? What will you give me? And then when you give them something, well, what you gave me isn't enough because you still have all of this that you worked for, so I want more of that. I mean, I guess you could call it socialism. That's essentially what it is, taking from those who work and those who are productive and giving to those who don't.
So. Yeah, it's world communism, basically, because we're giving billions in foreign aid to everywhere. At least National Socialists actually took care of their own people and they weren't hungry and starving and can afford to fix a broken leg, you know.
Absolutely. But, you know, the National Socialists, they went through some very tough times as well.
Yeah.
You know, the people in Germany before the rise of the National Socialists and the Weimar Republic, I mean, there were German families who were starving to death and eating wallpaper
paste,
trying to stay alive, while at the same time they were seeing these very wealthy Jewish people in society who owned cabarets and who were largely influential in the media and the banking system. They saw these people living lavish lives of kings while the rest of the people were starving and watching their children starve. So, you know, naturally this created animosity, but you don't ever hear this discussed.
Oh, no.
I remember when I was taught about the Third Reich and I was taught about Nazi Germany in class when I was in high school, basically the points that were touched upon was, number one, Hitler was the Antichrist and killed 6 million Jews.
Yep.
Number two, every single thing the National Socialists in Germany did was evil and the world did not benefit in any way, shape, or form from it. Number three, if you want to dig any deeper into these topics, you're a Nazi and a bigot. And that's basically what we were taught.
Yeah, I know. And then you never learn about any European genocides, of course.
Of course not. Of course not. not to say that there weren't wars. You know, Europeans have always had a very, very glorious martial history. And there's been a lot of infighting between different European populations. But at the same time, we are a martial people. You know, we are a people that have acquired territory in various ways. Some of those ways have been warfare. And even in the South here in the United States, in Dixie, our forefathers, they came here. You always hear the leftists make the argument. They say, oh, well, your ancestors in the South, they were immigrants just like the immigrants that you don't want flooding into your homeland.
Oh, yeah. Like, you can't compare pioneers and settlers to immigrants who come in and go to the welfare office right
away.
Well,
that's absolutely right, and I make no bones about it. You know, my immediate response to that is that, no, my ancestors were not immigrants in the sense that you conceive an immigrant to be. They did not come here to hop onto a welfare system and to suck the state dry. My ancestors were warriors, heroes, and conquerors. They conquered the indigenous population that was here, and they bequeathed what they conquered to their posterity. And I'm grateful that they did it. Otherwise, that I would not be here. Now, I think that some of it was tragic and some of it was probably very messy. But
well, this is how it's always been.
Absolutely.
In history.
This is the reality of the world. This is the reality of expanding living space and people, you know, building societies and building nations. This is how it works. Unfortunately, war and conquest is a part of it. But fortunately for us, our ancestors were very successful at that.
I think it's funny, too, how all these people who are coming down on the South for secession, you know, it's treason. Then they celebrate 4th of July, which is about seceding from the British.
Well, you know, that's another common misnomer, Lana, is that you hear people, and I've had people accuse me personally. They say, you know, William, you're inciting treason. You're inciting sedition. This is what you're doing. And I say, no, if you will go to U.S. Title 18 and you look up the definitions of treason and sedition, it's basically calling for the overthrow of the established political government or power. And Southern nationalists, we do not call for the overthrow of any governmental powers. We simply call for a separation from them. That's it. A peaceful and amicable separation. But just like our ancestors, we're also not naive enough to believe that should we be able to achieve this, in a perfectly legal and political way, that we would not have to defend it. We know that we would have to defend it because the side that you would be seceding from more than likely would not allow you to peacefully go. So.
That's right. I know there's so much disinfo surrounding the Civil War that they teach in school, just like World War II. I mean, it was a Northern War of Aggression. So what was going on in your head during this whole Confederate flag debacle?
Well, you know, I think these cultural Marxists, they seized upon a political opportunity, a very dastardly plan they had. You have Dylann Roof here that apparently goes into a church and he shoots up the church and kills nine innocent African-Americans. And they go back and they find pictures of him holding a Confederate flag. And then they try to use these photographs and this connection of the Confederate flag to Dylann Roof to create this broad and scathing indictment of everything Southern, of the Southern people, of their culture and of their heritage. And now you see this press to remove monuments, to dig up heroes and Civil War generals and exhume their bodies and move them to other places, to rename streets and rename parks. And what's important to understand is that this is not necessarily about flags and monuments. In fact, it's at its core, that's not what it's about. It's only a precursor. The removals of the flags and the monuments is a precursor to the genocide of the Southern people. And that's what they would like to see. Because what will happen inevitably, if you remove all of the flags, you remove all the monuments, you remove all the graves, you remove all the street signs, everything that reminds these leftists of slavery and of the Civil War and of what they deem as oppression. Once you remove all of those things, if you go to them and you ask them, is there anything else that reminds you of slavery and oppression? Well, they're going to look you square in the face and say, yes, you do, Southern white man. You remind us of slavery and oppression. And that's the logical conclusion. And people have to be, they have to be intelligent enough to see this. And given enough time, I think a lot of them will accept that.
Yeah, I feel like we're dealing with new Bolsheviks. We like to call them the American Bolsheviks. They're here, and they seem like they're even worse than the Soviets, and that's saying a lot.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it is. It's very similar to Bolshevism. You know, we call it cultural Marxism. This is a term that I use very heavily. I say cultural Marxist, and one of the reasons that I do this is because anyone who knows anything about the history of cultural Marxism and going back to the Frankfurt School, and they know that these philosophers and these men who dreamed up a lot of these ideas that eventually became critical theory, they know that at the core, these men were Jewish philosophers. But also at the same time, cultural Marxism is an umbrella term. So cultural Marxism is not just simply talking about the Jewish core and these philosophers who came up with these plans to alter society from the inside out, but it also encompasses all of their allies in this. You know, cultural Marxists can come in many shapes and varieties. You can have Black cultural Marxists, Hispanic cultural Marxists. It's an umbrella term that basically defines our enemy and their allies. So I think it's a very important term, and it's digestible for the people. Whereas if you simply call our enemies something else, it may not have the same effect with the people. But cultural Marxism seems to be very palpable and very digestible for the people. And they understand this term as being all-encompassing. So you don't leave any enemies out. You don't focus necessarily on specific enemies, but you don't leave any out either.
That's right. Well, I wanted to ask you, how can we start to organize? I mean, this both Southerners and Northerners, they're understanding this war that's being waged upon them. What are some ideas that you have?
Well, I have many ideas, and a lot of them are talked about and even implemented on the Southern nationalist level and in our own movement. But the main thing is organizing yourselves in an effective way, creating real-world networks, you know, not relegating your activism or the things that you're doing to the cyber world or to the internet. I'm a big advocate of not sitting behind keyboards for 24 hours a day talking about these issues. We need to get out there. We need to network. We need to build connections in the real world. And that's a start, but there's a lot more that we can do. I'm in favor of working with any group, especially those that are in close geographic proximity to myself and to the South, that favors secession and that favors autonomy and that loves their own people and has a folkish worldview and places a high value on their own people and their own folk. I'm all for cooperation with many of these groups, even if we don't agree on many political issues, as long as we can agree on these core values and these core basics. that our people must come first. Our own people are what's most important, and they're the most precious possession that we have in the material world, then, I mean, I think that we can build some very valuable and functioning relationships that can help us in the future. But ultimately, we'll have to organize on larger and larger levels. As we're able to maintenance these smaller networks and connections, they will grow, and more people will come in. And then the distances that separate us will ultimately shorten. But as a Southern nationalist, my main concern and my chief concern is the Southern people, because we have a distinct culture. We have a distinct identity from the rest of whites throughout the United States. And this is just true. I mean, if I go to New York or I go to Connecticut and I deal with any of these other Northern white Yankee liberals, it's very obvious to both of us that we are not the same people. We don't have the same values. We don't have the same traditional mindset. It's very prevalent that we're different and that we're not the same. So my focus is on my own people and my own culture here in the South. And anyone who wishes to work with us and to network with us and to help us, or that we can help, I'm sure that we would be glad to do that, as long as they shared our interests at heart. So I'm all about cooperation, but at the same time, I have to stand for my own people first and foremost.
That's right. America really is like, you know, 6-7 different countries. You can't compare, you know, Oregon to South Carolina. It's very different.
That's exactly right.
I also think it's important for Southerners and, you know, all white folks to begin to start getting physically healthy, eating clean, learning some skills, becoming physically strong. I think the South has been especially slammed with, you know, GMOs, fluoride, and other poisons. And without health, this is going to be even more difficult. So do you feel that there's value in trying to get Southerners more healthy?
Absolutely. I think people should try to live, you know, the healthiest life they possibly can. And I might be a tad hypocritical for saying that, because I'm not the healthiest eater and things like that. I enjoy a nice cold beer every now and then. I probably eat cheeseburgers more than I should, things like that. But I think
grass fed, raw cheese,
sure,
all good.
Sure. Absolutely. I mean, people need to be physically strong, physically healthy, and they need to be spiritually strong and spiritually healthy. I think that those two in combination will make you the strongest that you can possibly be. So yes, absolutely. But some of these things, unfortunately, you're not going to be able to avoid. Some of these GMOs, and it's becoming so widespread now, and they're in virtually, you know, 80% of the products that you're going to buy on the shelves of the grocery store. It's very difficult to avoid from a practical standpoint if you're a Southern person shopping at a grocery store. So.
Yeah, the one good thing about the South is the soil is great to grow, and you can grow pretty much year round because the weather's so great. So that's something to think about. And also, I've noticed in the South, there's actually a lot of farms you can buy meat from, and it's, you know, grass fed and clean, and they're not given, you know, tons of hormones and antibiotics. I think it's really important to educate some people down here. I think they've been given some of the GMO grits for too long, and I get concerned about that.
Oh, absolutely. Monsanto is probably one of the most evil corporations on the face of the planet. At least that's my view. A lot of the things they do are very destructive. And especially the altering of the food. I don't believe that anyone should be playing God with our food supply and with the genetics of animals and things of this nature. I think that this is totally, totally wrong. And I think most Southerners would agree to that. We're very traditionally minded. Most of us are Christians, although not all. But I think that anything that is destructive to your society and to your people, I think that, you know, you need to be very scrutinous of this, and you need to be very careful about how much these things are allowed to permeate your society. And not just dealing with food, but other things as well. Subversive political influences, for example. The dissemination of pornography and these things like this that are damaging to the psyche and to the mind. They create complexes. They create, you know, unhealthy mental states. I think things like these need to be, you know, for all intents and purposes, suppressed to a certain degree so that they can't have their negative impacts on the people. That may be a bit authoritarian, yeah. But I still think that.
No, but you know, when you're with like-minded people, you don't see it as tyranny because you all agree on it.
Sure.
So that's a good thing about an ethnostate. You agree on those things. So it's not authoritarian. It's what you all want together.
Absolutely. I think the problem that a lot of people have today is that they're inundated with so much propaganda around the clock. If I could make one recommendation to fellow Southerners, or to anyone for that matter, it would be turn off your television. Open up books and read books. Turn off your television. Spend less time on your computer. Get your head out of your iPhone, and take part in reality and in the world. Learn, study, educate yourself. But reading books is the most important, because people who read a lot think a lot. And when you read, it helps you practice not only your thoughts, but it also helps you practice your speech. So the more you read, the better you will speak, and the more cognitive your thoughts will be. You know, you will think in complete sentences instead of run-on sentences and things of that nature. But if you're sitting around watching the Kardashians all day long on the television, or watching all of this garbage that comes out of the television, then of course garbage in is going to equal garbage out. Reality does not come from a screen. And that's what people need to realize. Reality is not what's projected from that screen. So turn the screen off. Open up books, go outside, you know, visit with your neighbors, make real world connections, and you're going to have a good, fulfilled life, in my opinion. But if you're constantly listening to the radio and constantly watching television, and you're inundating yourself constantly with this propaganda, it's going to influence the way that you think. It's going to influence what you believe. It's going to change who you are, literally. It's very dangerous.
It gets in there unconsciously, and then you begin to censor yourself and behave that way. And like, where did that come from? You know, oh, it was programmed into you.
Absolutely. Well, they call it programming for a reason. That's exactly what it does. You know, it programs you what to wear, what to think, what to eat, how to act, what's popular, what's not. I can decide all of these things for myself without a television. And I think everybody should take that same stance and turn off the televisions and turn off the radios. Stop listening to all of the, you know, all of this disgusting music that denigrates women and is completely inappropriate, and be good, virtuous people. You know, try to better yourself, have self-esteem, you know, recognize that you have a self-value that's unequivocal to anything else. And don't let the television tell you who you should be. Don't let the propaganda mold and shape who you are. Recognize who you are, love your own people, and fight for them. That would be my advice to anyone.
Well, tell us about membership with the League and how Southerners can get involved.
Well, the League of the South is a national organization that's made up of different state chapters. The League of the South is a dues-paying organization. All of our members who join the League of the South have options on different dues that they can pay. Typically, the standard dues are $50 a year. All of these funds go to help support our activism. They go towards our billboard campaigns, and basically to help with the administration of the League and its members. People who are interested in joining the League, which I encourage everyone to do, can visit our website at www.leagueofthesouth.com. And there there's a section where they can make inquiries, where they can join, and they can find more information about our activism and what we're out here doing. Also, we have a state website in Georgia. Right now, the state website is under construction, so a lot of the old material that was there has been taken down, and I'm currently working on updating that material and putting new things there. It's probably going to be done sometime by the end of August. But our Georgia website is, I'll go ahead and give you the complete URL, because there is no www, it's not World Wide Web prefixed. The URL is http://georgials.org. So the listeners can go there. Right now, it's only a shell of a website. We're still working on the reconstruction and the update of the website, but hopefully soon it will be up and running with tons of information, tons of activist resources, downloadable PDF flyers that can be printed out and passed out at your discretion, and a lot of other resources for our activists. So you can visit those two sites and you can make inquiries there. Also, many of us are on Facebook. We can be contacted through Facebook if you have more inquiries or you'd like to see what you can do to help or to join. We're easy to find. So,
and do you plan gatherings for people to network as well?
Absolutely. We try to have multiple demonstrations throughout the year. Some of these demonstrations are basically held at busy intersections or on roadsides where we all assemble. We hold our signs and we hold our flags. The signs give a message to the people. The flags are statements of visibility. We pass out literature. And during these demonstrations, usually, you know, there will be a lot of fellowshipping in the evenings at the hotels. We'll all get together. We'll discuss politics. We'll discuss life. We'll discuss what we can do to improve, how we can help strengthen ourselves and grow. And it's a great fellowship and learning experience for all that are involved. So yes, we try to do this multiple times a year. And we do have a national conference every year. The past 2 years, the conference has been held at our national building there in Wetumpka, Alabama, which is where our speeches were given this year. And at that building, we have our conference. We have people from all over the South that come to the conference. Most of them are league members. Some of them are just curious and supporters. Everyone is welcome to come there and to participate in the conference and to see who we are and what we're all about. But basically, we're just Southern people who love our own people. We love our own culture, and we're going to fight for it and promote it. And that's what the League of the South is, and the Southern Nationalist Movement is. And we're growing. So everyone is welcome to come and to seek us out. And if they have questions, we'll do our best to answer them and tell them about our worldview and who we are. So.
Well, William, thank you for your time this evening. I think you're doing valuable work.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Hopefully, I will have many years left to continue this work.
If you haven't been down south, make a trip and go see places like Charleston, South Carolina, Savannah, Georgia, New Orleans, Beaufort, South Carolina. Come and see the lovely historic architecture and landscape created by Europeans. You'll feel like you're in a quaint European town, but surrounded by massive southern oaks and, of course, lots of good weather. It's really a magical feeling. It's not all trailer parks and missing front teeth. Sadly, many of these beautiful towns are being run down by newcomers and other inhabitants that don't respect this beauty or those who made it. For traditional Europeans, we understand the spiritual need for beauty. In fact, I'd recommend an older documentary called Why Beauty Matters by Roger Scruton on the BBC. You can watch it for free on Vimeo. I cringe when I hear the onslaught of disinfo surrounding the Civil War, the transatlantic slave trade, and the South in general. If you want to dive into this subject, there's a publisher called the Confederate Reprint Company with many older books on these topics. Get them before you can't anymore. That's all for now. You can connect with me on Facebook, Twitter, or Google Plus, and if you want to send me a guest suggestion, please do so. And don't miss Dr. David Duke next week on Radio 314. Have a great weekend.
I remember to this day the bright red Georgia plain, how it stuck to the tire after the summer rain. Willpower made that old car go, a woman's mind told me that's so. Oh, how I wish we were back. Back on the road.